everybody to House Resources. It is Monday, and present are Representative Dick, Representative Heron, Representative Wilson, Representative Gardner, and Co-Chair Feige, and myself, Co-Chair Seaton. Remind everybody about their cell phones. And today we have two bills to introduce. House Bill 295, closing certain land to mineral energy or entry, and SB 91, which is sport fish guiding services. Our intention is to hear those bills, get them introduced, have any questions and public testimony, and then set them aside for the next meeting. And we also have HB 328, which is separate accounting. The committee and members of the public have the committee substitute version E, which just incorporates the discussions that we had with the Department of Revenue and their request for some changes for implementation processes, and also incorporates the education tax credit language that we had as an amendment previously was listed as B1. So we'll have public testimony on that bill towards the end. We have several members of the public to testify, and so that'll be what we're going to do. Myself and Representative Heron have bills up in other committees at 1:30. I'll be passing the gavel to my co-chair and plan to return as soon as possible. Is there anything else to come before the committee before we begin? Seeing nothing, House Bill 295. Welcome. And would you identify yourself and for the record and present the bill?
Good afternoon, Co-Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Julie Lucky, and I'm staff for Representative Mike Hawker's office. Now, you have a full agenda today, and we start a little late, so I'd like to give a brief overview of the bill and then take any questions the committee might have. House Bill 295 approves Mineral Order 1121, which closes certain lands in the Upper Girdwood Valley area to new mining claims. And the intent of that is to allow recreational use in these areas and to make sure that incompatible uses aren't occurring on the same land. The land has been historically used for recreational purposes. I believe mining closures have been in place, I think, since the 90s, but DNR can give us a little bit more information on that. The state, the municipality of Anchorage, the community of Girdwood have all designated these lands for recreational use in their management plans, and the approval of House Bill 295 and Mineral Order 1121 would allow more long-range plans for recreational opportunities to develop. The mining closure is supported by the Department of Natural Resources, the municipality of Anchorage, the community of Girdwood, and I'd like to point out the Alaska Miners Association has no problem with the bill and has put in a letter of support. That's basically what the bill does, and there is a CS. I'm not sure if you wanted to speak about the CS or do that in the next meeting.
Go ahead with the CS. We'll after you're done, I'll take a move, whatever.
A motion. All right. The CS is backslash B, and the main change is the addition of Section 3. And it is my understanding, and we can have the DNR speak to this as well, that there were a few federal mining claims that were left out in a previous legislation in 2003 that closed a particular area of the land. This will be closing additional land. There were two federal mining claim numbers that were left out, so this is a technical amendment to ensure that those that were left out are included. The inclusion of Section 3 also required a title change and a change in the purpose and intent language just to include Mineral Closing Order 593, which was the previous Mineral Closing Order.
Questions from the committee? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there any opposition at all to this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, we have not received any opposition, and it is my understanding throughout the public process on the mineral closing order, which was fairly extensive, there was no public opposition. You can confirm that with the DNR representative, but all the things I've looked through, there was no actual opposition. There was a little concern about moving to an indefinite closure versus a 10-year closure. In this area, it's been a succession of 10-year closures. And this statutory would, of course, put a statutory approval of the mineral closing order put forth an indefinite closure. It's my understanding, and DNR might be better to speak to that, but that's kind of the way that they do things. And the temporary orders were to see if this land would actually be used for recreational activities. And since it has been used, DNR feels that at this point an indefinite closure is in line with their standard practices.
Thank you. Would you like to hear from DNR? We have Wynn Menifee in the room and Adam Smith online. Yes or no? Okay. Representative Dick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question. I did find the letter from Alaska Miners Association. It was signed by Fred Parody. And I read here, it said, we would note that should use cease, we would like to see the closure orders reversed and the area reopened to mineral development. Is that somewhere in the CS?
Through the chairman, Representative Dick, I would prefer to have DNR discuss what the process would be for reopening to reopening the area to mining claims. It's my understanding there is a process in place, which is why it's not a permanent closure, but it would take a statutory action on our part.
Thank you.
And let the record reflect we've been joined by Representative Munoz. Any other questions from the committee? Okay, with that, anybody in the room that would like to testify? Online, we have Diana Livingston from Girdwood 2020. Ms. Livingston, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Please state your name, affiliation, and proceed.
My name is Diana Livingston. I'm co-chair of Girdwood 2020, residing in Girdwood, Alaska. And I have submitted a letter that I wrote on February 17, 2011, as written testimony. Contains the substance of our support. However, I would like to say that Girdwood 2020 has a beneficial partnership with the Girdwood Board of Supervisors, the elected board that represents the community, and with Alaska Resort. And during the periods of successive tenure closures, this group has always supported the closures because of development and potential development of recreational uses, and the recreational uses have only intensified in the last 10 years, and we fully support the bill. I'm available for any questions, and the community is. It's my understanding that the Crow Creek Mine, the TUIs, have been contacted and they have no objection.
Any questions for Ms. Livingston from the committee? Thank you, Ms. Livingston. Appreciate it.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Okay, at this time, I'll entertain a motion to adopt the Bravo version of the CS. Representative Wilson.
I move that we adopt CS for House Bill number 295, version B, as our working document.
Hearing no objections, version B is the now the working document. Discussion. What is the will of the committee? Representative Dick?
I would like to hear, I mean, obviously this isn't going to go back to mining, but I would like to hear from somebody from DNR what the answer would be. Should the orders reversed, would it be available for mineral development? It's highly, highly, highly unlikely.
I'm Wayne Menifee, Chief of Operations for the Division of Mining, Land, and Water with DNR. And the The fact that this is being put in legislation would take a statutory change to reverse it, but typically with minimum closing orders that if we found the need because all the recreational developments would go away, is we would take an administrative action to reverse that. What we would do is like we did an interim mineral order, the commissioner would do that and then come back to the legislature to follow up with them. But because we're getting the legislative approval here, we would have to get that approved.
Can I answer your question? That's good. Okay. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Is there any existing mineral activity that would be affected by this? Or would it be just new entries?
Representative, through the chair, it's only new mining claims that are prevented. So all existing mineral activity, and really that is only up at Crow Pass area. And the deal is that any existing claims don't get eliminated by a mineral closing order. It just means you can't stake new claims.
Representative Dick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then with that question, I'm just trying to come on basis here. The ones that do exist now, is there any, if this is designated for recreational, would there be any problem with access to the existing mineral claims?
Representative, through the chair, the mineral closing order, in effect, does not dictate how the land's used other than preventing future mining claims. So, therefore, the existing claims that are up there can be used for mineral extraction and other uses like recreational uses can also occur in those areas.
Follow-up? But my question, again, was just in terms of access, should they want to dump trucks or cats or whatnot, there is no problem with them getting equipment in and out.
Representative through the chair, there is no problem.
Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee? At this time, I'll entertain a motion to move this out of committee. Representative Wilson.
I move the CS for House Bill number 295, version B, out of committee with individual recommendations and any fiscal notes.
Hear no objection. CS for House Bill number 295, version Bravo, is moved out of committee. Take a brief at ease, sign the paperwork. We've been joined by Representative Kawasaki. And next up will be Senate Bill. Wow, Senate Bill. How about that? Senate Bill 91.
For the record, my name is Cheyenne Ely, intern for Senator McGuire. And SV1 guarantees the continuation of the sport fish guide licensing and reporting program, as well as provides an effective date. SB 91 extends the sunset date of the program, which is already in place. Legislation for this program was first passed in 2004. This program has proven to be beneficial to the sport fishing industry as well as resource managers. It requires licensing and regulation of sport fishing operators and sport fishing guides and sport fishing vessels. The program has provided an effective date, or sorry, excuse me, the program has provided an average of 1,541 sport fishing business licenses and 1,828 sport fishing guide licenses annually. 90% of the license holders are Alaska residents. The sport fishing guide industry has taken more than 2.6 million clients fishing from 2005 to 2010, totaling more than 625,000 guided fishing trips in Alaska. Guided sport fishing has become an integral part of Alaska's tourism economy. In 2007, $1.39 billion was spent on licensing and stamp trip-related expenditures, fishing packages, equipment, and real estate used for the fishing. This spending supported more than 15,879 jobs in Alaska and provided 545.3 million in income. This bill has provided an accurate accounting for Alaska's resources, which are being harvested. Federal law for guided halibut sport fishing is tied to the Alaska sport fishing logbooks, and failure to keep this program in place would likely result in the development of federal logbook for halibut, which would create duplication of efforts at a later date. Alaska is exempt from participation in the NOAA Fisheries National Saltwater Angler Registry Program, in part as a result of the information collected through the Sport Fishing Guide Licenses and Reporting Program. The committee has passed this bill before, and I urge members to continue this sport.
Questions from the committee? Representative Gardner.
Thank you. And I understand that this is simply an extension of an existing program, but I have a question that comes from the sponsor's statement, and that has to do with being exempt from the National Saltwater Angler Registry. And what is the reason, or what is the function of the Angler Saltwater Registry, and why do we want to be exempt from it?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, there's someone from the department that's here that's probably better to answer that question than myself.
Okay, Representative Gardner. And we do have somebody from Fish and Game.
Yeah, I'll wait for that.
Okay. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you. Are the logbooks done manually written, or are they also done through data entry?
Representative Munoz, through the chair. They are now done electronically, as that's my understanding.
Okay. As a follow-up to that. In a previous hearing on this bill in a previous legislature, it seems to me that one of the concerns was the cost of reentering the data. The department had additional costs when they took manual logbooks and had to reenter the data. I'm wondering, has there been any savings to the department by going electronic, if indeed that's the case?
Representative Munoz, to the chair, that's probably, yeah, again, a question that the department was better to answer.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for being here. A question for you. I know this bill's come up before resources probably, I don't know, a lot of different times, but the discussion has always been, or has been at one point in time, we have licenses for a lot of different occupations. This, of course, is another license for a different occupation, but this occupation doesn't have a board attached to it, and I'd like just to hear the sponsor's comments on why there isn't a board attached to a license.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, I could probably ask Senator McGuire and the rest of our staff as to what their thoughts are on creating a board for this program, or the department may be better to answer that.
Okay. Thanks.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Dick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question here in the sponsor statement. It said estimated non-resident spending on sport fishing was more than $650 million in 2007. Is that just everything they spend from the time they arrive in Alaska, and to what does that represent? That's $650 million.
As far as I'm aware, it's just general figures as to the spending. I'd have to Representative Dick, through the chair, I would have to get back to you on that, if that's okay, or the department may know.
Well, it's not make or break on the vote, but I'm just very curious myself as to whether if we didn't have sport fishing, is that the sum total of what we would lose if we did not have this non-resident spending on sport fishing? That'd be my question.
Representative Dick, through the chair. I am unfortunately unsure of that. I don't know this. The department may be able to answer that, but if not, I can absolutely get back to you as well.
Okay. Any other questions from committee? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This time, Lisa Evans from Department of Fish and Game.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Evans. I'm the Assistant Director for the Sport Fish Division in Alaska Department of Fish and Game. The Sport Fish Guide Licensing Program is an important management tool that we use to manage our fisheries in this state. We collect the data for a lot of different reasons, but we use it extensively for decisions that are made by the International Pacific Halibut Commission and the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. They use the data to analyze their regulatory options and inform their decisions, and hopefully maintain the least conservative regulatory structure possible. The department also uses this data in different ways throughout the state. Our fisheries managers document the harvest patterns within specific time frames, such as a bag limit or a season date. And then we use that data to evaluate and update our own regulatory structure for certain species, both for conservation and to ensure maximum amount of opportunity for Alaskans and others that want to fish in our state. We collect the specific angler harvest information through the logbooks. In 2010 and 11, we asked for information on sable fish in southeast Alaska, specifically so that we could go to the Board of Fisheries and ask them to repeal an 8-fish limit. So we were successful in doing that using this data. It's just one example of how we've been able to use the logbook data for enhancing and creating more opportunity for anglers. We've used freshwater logbook catch and harvest statistics in Kodiak recently to establish pre-season management objectives and then also manage in-season for opportunities. We have responded as a department to the concerns that the sport fish guide industry gave us regarding how quickly we were able to turn around our data and the electronic capturing of that data. We have not been able to move to a electronic logbook per se. The guides still record their data on a hard copy form. They submit that to us, but what we have done is turn that. We take that and we scan that logbook page rather than doing manual data entry. And we've been able to turn that data around then. For instance, for halibut, we took 2 months' worth of data and had the results out within a 2-week period. So we have significantly improved the amount of time that we can return the data. We have not been able, we've done some calculations on going to a completely electronic system, and we're still examining that and seeing if it's even feasible for us to go there. We intend to implement that scannable logbook form for freshwater this year and see if we can further improve our efficiency. Essentially, sport fishing is a $1.4 billion industry in our state, and that was data collected in 2007, and that is trip-related expenditures. So that includes airfare, lodging, equipment, guide services. Without this, we will be left with without a very necessary tool in our toolbox to ensure that we're managing our fisheries in a way that protects it for future generations and creates opportunities. With that, all.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Two questions. First of all, the funds that are raised through this program for your department, are they adequate to cover your costs? Do they generate anything in excess? And then the second question is if you can answer the question about the National Saltwater Angler Registry, what that is and why we would want to be exempt from it.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner. We, I believe, have a $400,000 fiscal note attached to this bill. The receipts that we receive through the program are approximately $250,000, and the remaining balance of $150,000 is covered through fish and game funds, which is sport fish license sales. And then in regards to the NOAA Saltwater Registry, that is a new program that NOAA implemented last year, I believe. And for states that don't sell, they only sell freshwater fishing licenses, NOAA is requiring the sale of a saltwater fishing license so that they can collect harvest data on saltwater sport fisheries. We have, in Alaska, been able to apply for and receive an exemption from that program because of our statewide harvest survey and this guide logbook program, because we collect the data that they're already collecting.
Thank you. So I understand then that the function of the National Saltwater Registry is simply for the data collection, or largely for the data collection. We're already doing it, so we don't need to have a second way of doing the same thing.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Gardner.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thanks. And again, I've seen a bill like this or something similar to it for a number of years, and part of the personal services, the $290,000, has always been explained that it's cumbersome to take a piece of paper to try to figure out and put it into digital format. And we've heard time and time again during the budget cycle, especially, that that's something you're getting to. I've only been a member for 6 years, but I remember my first year on the House Fisheries Committee that it was mentioned, and I just want to hear why that has not been accomplished yet, and whether the funds, according to this, the $400,000 request, how it gets you closer to that, or if there's another budget item that needs to be put into the operating budget.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, we have not decreased the number of staff that we have working on this program, because last year was the first year that we implemented the scannable logbook form. My recollection is that we also ran, we were ground truthing that and making sure that it was working correctly. With the application for freshwater that we see this year, we may see some ways for efficiency. We have not gone to a completely electronic program because we frankly haven't found one that's cost effective to do so. Some preliminary estimates that we've looked at based on other work that's been done in Gulf of Mexico, it'll cost upwards of $1 million to $1.25 million. So the part of the other obstacle that I think we face is that we have not gone to a completely electronic point of sale system for our sport fish license purchases. And those kind of tie together.
Thank you.
Any question? Any other questions from the committee? Could you have just give me an idea of what exactly is the scannable form, and what kind of, is it just, are you scanning the hard copy and then entering it from that? Or are you, is this like a mark sense where you fill in the bubble with a number two pencil and then it gets scanned and the data gets recorded, much like the voting machine I use at home?
Mr. Chair, I believe that it is just a scanned copy of the actual logbook page. I can double check that, though, and get back to you as soon as I'm back to the office. But I believe they take the logbook page and then they scan it, and there's some a software that then reads those entries. And if the page itself has numbers of, so for instance, it records the license number, the sport fish license number, the name of the individual fishing, and then the number of fish that they caught, harvested, released.
Okay. Has the department looked at, you hear the phrase, an app for that. I mean, most of these young fishing guides that I know of certainly got cell phones that they carry around, and you know, my kid is always telling me about all the great apps that are out there. But is that something the department's investigated at all? Or?
Mr. Chair, we are investigating that right now. We've have a small team of individuals that have been looking at options that have been implemented elsewhere in the state as well as in the country, and exploring whether or not that's something that we could implement here in Alaska.
Okay, fair enough. And as far as the overall program to record harvest amounts like this, I understand that, you know, the data is certainly very useful and allows us to more precisely quantify, you know, what is being taken out there. What kind of pushbacks have you got from the sport fishing industry at all, if any?
Mr. Chair, in general, we find when we've held public meetings on this program, we found that there's pretty broad-based support. I would say roughly 80 to 85% of the guiding industry supports the guide logbook program. There are those that feel like it's cumbersome and not essential. In general, I think that they understand that this information is important to keeping a less conservative management structure in place.
Okay, so the nature of their complaints has mostly been they just didn't want to do it, or?
I think.
Were they just sort of opposed to it on a general basis?
Mr. Chair, I would say that the in general, it is cumbersome to fill it out on the boat while you're trying to serve your clients. Also, I would say that there's been some objection in the past to having to pay the $100 license fee, and that's kind of primarily what we've heard.
Okay. Any other questions from committee? Thank you, Ms. Evans. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Any discussion on Senate Bill 91? Representative Calzaghe?
Just under discussion, and this bill, I swear it's come up a lot of times. I don't know how many.
Because they keep extending the.
As long as we only sunset it every 2 years or so, I guess we're bound to see it once in a while. You know, my objection from the very beginning has been whether this program is necessary. We do a lot of licensing for a lot of different things, barbers and hairdressers, medical doctors, truck drivers. We have a lot of different licensing out there, and so I question whenever a license like this comes before us. I understand the value of the data that's collected for the Department of Fish and Game, and I don't know if there's a better way in order to get that data. But, I mean, I don't like imposing any additional licensing requirements on sport fish guides if they're already, you know, they already have a business license to operate. You know, do we really have to go the extra $100 in order to get a guide license on top of it? And I struggled with this from the first time I've seen this bill. Again, I don't know if there's a better way in order to force compliance and get the information that's necessary for Fish and Game, but I sure do hate adding more layers of licensures to residents of the state. So.
Any other comments from committee? At this time, I'll entertain a motion. Representative Munoz.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move CS for Senate Bill 91, Version M, with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations from committee.
There's no public comment? Nobody speak to it?
We don't have anybody here or online.
Okay. Obviously, terribly controversial.
Leave it easy. Back to order. Hearing no objection, the CS for Senate Bill number 91, version M, is moved out of committee. We'll take a brief at ease, sign the paperwork. Time the Resources Committee come back to order. Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move CS for House Bill 328, Version E, as a working document.
And hearing no objections, Version E of House Bill 328 is now the working document. Basically, what we're going to do here is going to take public testimony from a variety of agencies and companies. We have several folks in the room that are going to testify as to this bill. And we have Joanna Bales from Division of Revenue, who we all heard from on Friday, available to answer any questions. So, first up, Tom Williams. Good afternoon, Mr. Williams. If you would state your name and affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. My name is Thomas K. Williams, and I am a tax attorney with BP. I'm here to testify today about this new CS, or the CS new draft E, for House Bill 328, which would reenact separate accounting. The reason I'm here is twofold, partly. I had the chance back in 1978, when I worked for the state as the director of petroleum revenue, of taking separate accounting and making it work the first time. And there's a number of things that we did then that you may want to keep in mind as you consider this version and reinstating it. I was in charge of petroleum revenue from 1975 until 1979. And then Governor Hammond appointed me to be Commissioner of Revenue 1979 to the end of his term, in the end of 1982. After that, I had a job for about a year with a Seattle law firm in Anchorage, a position that I got through the good graces of Elmer Rasmussen. And then I was vice president and general counsel of Cook Inlet Region, Incorporated, one of the 12 regional corporations, until late 1987. So then I started with BP. So I'm coming up on 25 years with BP, but have a checkered past, if you will. Some might say I'm a gamekeeper turned poacher or a poacher turned gamekeeper. And maybe there's a third category because Siri was a private landowner and had oil and gas income. So seen it from all three sides of the table.
So you were responsible for setting up the system that at least got the ball rolling.
Well, the legislature passed separate accounting, of course, but they decided to put it in the commissioner, Sterling Gallagher. What a great name for Commissioner of Revenue, Sterling Gallagher. You know, he assigned it to my division rather than the income tax division, which was running the personal income tax. We had one of those then. And so there were a couple of things that, I mean, that we had to consider at that time in trying to make it work. One of the key things is that there's a big difference between a severance tax or a production tax, even one like ACES that is based on an operating margin or a net basis, and an income tax. When you're talking about a severance tax or a production tax, as long as the act of severing it or producing it is in your state, the legislature is pretty much free to set the tax rate how it will. You could say, for instance, the tax is $5 a barrel, period. Nothing more complicated than that. And that would be perfectly valid as a severance tax. But you couldn't say that the tax, well, I mean, with the income tax, you have to have the income earned in the state. If I have a family business with my sisters in Arizona, you can't tax my share of the income from that because the Constitution says the income earning activity has to have some sort of connection with the state where you are. It's called, the lawyers like to call it nexus, and that's the technical term, N-E-X-U-S. But that's a constraint that you have. Of course, another one is you're not supposed to discriminate against in favor of intrastate versus interstate or foreign commerce. With the income tax area, that's less of a problem usually than in some other kinds of taxes that you can see. Fundamentally, you have two basic approaches that are both trying to get to the same answer in the context of an income tax. And that is, how much did you make here? That's the question. How much did you make in Alaska from your activities? Separate accounting tackles that head on. And it says, okay, how much did you make if we look just at the part of your business that's in the state and nothing else? Pretend that you're just standing alone with none of the rest of the business that you may be a part of. Conceptually, that's a very pure approach. It tackles it directly head on. And for an enterprise here, whether it's running a shop or a store, or whether it's providing a service, a furnace repair or something like that, or whatever, or a car dealership, any number of things like that, that's fairly simple because you got a local business and you may not have anything outside the state. It gets a little bit trickier, perhaps, where you have a business that's that includes in-state and out-of-state parts. And one of the examples I've ginned up here to illustrate that has to do with fishing, commercial fisheries. And it's not a realistic example because I'm not a fisherman, so I'm sure the numbers are going to be totally wrong. But suppose I were a fisherman who had a permit to fish in Alaskan waters, even though I lived in Vancouver, British Columbia. And suppose I came up in my fishing boat, I fueled it up in Vancouver, came up to Alaskan waters, fished under my permit, and then took the fish down to Pike Street Market, which is a premium market in Seattle, sold them there, and then went back to BC. Suppose I paid $250,000 for fuel, $500,000 for my crew, $100,000 for supplies, $150,000 on my boat loan, and $100,000 in depreciation for my boat. Adding that all up is a $1,100,000 of expenses I would have. And here's, I mean, as I said, I don't know whether that's realistic. I know the next part is not realistic. Suppose I got $2 million for selling the fish in Seattle, so I made $900,000 that season. I'd say most fishermen would say that's, I guess they would say it's not very realistic to have such a profitable business. But here, just assume, bear with me.
Those fishermen would never admit to that, so.
But think of it now. Okay, so I bought fuel in British Columbia when I started out. I bought fuel when I was in Alaska while I was fishing. And when I got to Seattle, I bought a little bit more fuel to get back home. You know, I had the crew. I was fishing in Canadian waters, Alaskan territorial waters, water outside the three-mile limit. And then I was coming back through Puget Sound to deliver the fish. Where did I make my $900,000? How much of that, if you had a separate accounting tax, how much money of that $900,000 would you say was earned in Vancouver, British Columbia? How much was earned in Alaska? How much was earned in Seattle? And was any of it earned on the high seas while I was out fishing outside of all these jurisdictions? That's a problem. There's not a clear answer. You can say, well, I would take, you know, how much of my gas purchases were in Alaska versus someplace else, and I might use that fraction, and might say how much of my time was in Alaska waters versus others. But now you've gotten away from the pure idea of taxing the business straight as if it's standing alone in Alaska, because it's a seamless whole. And so you start making assumptions about how you will divide this cost up, or where you separately allocate it to each place. If we only had costs in Alaska, does that mean I have a loss for Alaska purposes, and I only have income in Washington State where I got the revenue from selling the fish? Those are issues that you have with separate accounting that, even though on the face of it it sounds very straightforward and has that appeal, when you have a multi-state business, it gets more complicated. Another example, and I won't go through it all with numbers and everything else, but suppose I were a miner. I had a gold mine in Alaska, and I got the ore and I ground it down and did some purifying and everything else, but then I flew it out to Idaho, and there I had a gold refinery where I could make the ingots of 4/9 pure gold, you know. Again, if I took out $100,000 worth of gold, how much did I make from Alaska versus how much did I make in terms of purifying the gold into the 4/9 quality? So it was commercially, I mean, it was like specie then, it was money. How would I do that? How would I allocate the costs between Idaho and Alaska, and how would I allocate the income to Alaska, or would it all be Idaho's? So those are the types of issues that you have with a separate accounting tax, which, despite its purity, become analytically or mechanically very difficult to find answers to. The apportionment approach arose in response after World War II. A lot of academic institutions in the East Coast, law schools and economists and folks like that, wanted to see uniform system of laws, because after the war, as the nation went into prosperity during the Truman and Eisenhower years, there were a lot of things going on, a lot of new things like building subdivisions and all that sort of stuff. And they wanted to have uniform systems of laws because it was really horrible if you had one state like New York with a set of laws and a different set of laws in New Jersey and a different set of laws in Connecticut, and so on, all patchwork across the country. And so they came up with a bunch of uniform laws, including one called the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act, UDITPA, which is no easier to say than the full thing. What I like to say is it's the same formula that they used later on with the multi-state tax compact. So I can say MTC and usually get that one right. So I'm going to call it the MTC formula. But basically, the approach there is this idea, rather than try to find out exactly how much you made as if this piece of business was standing alone in Alaska, you look at the potential of what it has in Alaska to generate income and compare it to the potential to generate income everywhere that it does business. And then you allocate its actual profits overall back to the different states in proportion to the income-generating potential that's there. This was the approach that's in MTC formula, UDIPPA, and Alaska, I think, became the first state in 1959 to adopt it. New Jersey was soon after, and a number of other states. And we pioneered that as a state, and that's even before I started to work for the Department of Revenue. But we had this idea that you would slice the pie, and our present statute slices the pie on the basis of three different measures of income-generating potential. Your property in Alaska, how much have you invested in Alaska versus how much have you invested everywhere? The idea being that you should get the same return on your Alaskan investments overall as you do on your businesses, your in-business investments and the rest of your business. Your sales, again, the idea being that a dollar sale should bring in the same amount of margin in Alaska as a sale versus anywhere else. And finally, your production, that a barrel produced in Alaska should generate, have comparable income potential for your business as a barrel from anywhere else. We're not disadvantaged in terms of our oil or gas. So that's the assumption that we have, and we take those three percentages, the in-state percentages for each one, take the average, and then we multiply that by BP's worldwide business or ConocoPhillips' worldwide business, ExxonMobil's. Siri was a little simpler, although actually Siri had business from outside the state as well. But, you know, that's how this present tax works. It's not free of issues because, obviously, it's only as good as your assumption is that the factors are, in fact, representative of income-generating potential. The in-state percentage factor will be as income-generating potential as the factor outside the state. One thing that you do know for every company in an extractive business, like oil and gas or coal or something like that, is that as you get to the end of life, it gets more and more expensive to get the next barrel of oil out of the ground or the next cubic foot of gas or the next ton of coal because you've taken the good stuff and it gets harder and harder. For oil and gas, there's less pressure and you're getting more water being produced with it and at a slower rate. Ultimately, what happens is you reach the point where the cost of getting the next barrel out are equal to the value of that barrel. They eat it all up. And then you're breaking even. If you keep playing the game and if nothing else changes, you'll end up starting to lose money with the barrel after that or the barrels that come after that. So one thing that we know for sure is for every company that produces oil and gas or does coal or whatever it is its business in Alaska, the time will come when it will want separate accounting. Because the profitability of its ton of coal or its barrel of oil or its sale, dollar of sale or its dollar of investment, will be less in Alaska than it will be somewhere else. So separate accounting is a good tool, a good structure to use at the end of field life. There are, however, it's a function of individual companies. There are people coming into Alaska who aren't finding elephants. They're developing the smaller fields. Those fields don't have the same margins to start with. And as they develop their fields, their margins are not going to be at all comparable to what Prudhoe Bay or Kuparuk was when they started production. And they may not even be comparable to what those margins are today. We don't know. Because, again, they don't have to tell what their specific margins are to anybody but the Department of Revenue. So the point is that you can't be sure whether you're going to get more money or less overall from one tax or another, because it depends on how close people are to where they will cross the line, individual businesses. So that's how it works and how they get to conceptually these two different competing systems for answering the same question. How much did you make in Alaska from your business? There's a couple of constitutional elements that we had to address when I worked on the tax back, 1978, 34 years ago. I'm only 64 now. I'm not 900 years old. So that's scary to think it was that long ago. But anyway, one of the things we had to do was we had to look at realization. One of the things that the ACES tax look is it takes value versus price. And generally, price is what you sell it for, and value is what you could have sold it for. Sometimes people can beat the value. Sometimes they find a niche and they can sell above it, and their price will be higher than the value. But oftentimes people find themselves not able to fully exploit what the market might otherwise allow, and they may fall short. Since it's a tax on income, you can't really impute income by saying if you sold the oil for $90 a barrel but you could have gotten $92, to tax the $5 they didn't get is to tax income that wasn't there. That doesn't seem like common sense. And in fact, it isn't common sense in the eyes of the Constitution. Another one that you have is when you get to the cost of getting it from the North Slope to the West Coast where it's refined, or even to Fairbanks or Valdez or Nikiski where it gets refined. I mean, right now, transportation costs, you make a reference in the bill on page 5, to transportation costs under AS 4355, section 150. That's in the ACES tax. The ACES tax allows the department to set aside a tariff that you actually paid in favor of a tariff that it calculates on the basis of what it thinks is fair, just, and reasonable. I won't get into details about how 150 is being implemented on the ACES tax, but again, what I'd say is to the extent that you are disregarding or would be in using that statute, the state or the department could be disregarding what is actually paid, it will either be allowing an over-deduction, which won't be a constitutional issue, or an under-deduction for actual costs, and that will be an issue because you're taxing income then that wasn't there. State can always tax less income than was there, but not tax more. So that would be an issue. There's one other thing that we had when I was back in all that those many years ago. We followed New Jersey and the multi-state tax compact formula, UDIPA, by saying in terms of figuring how big is the family of companies that you're going to look at, in terms of whose income are you going to start with, and then that's the pie and you cut a slice out of it and say that's the Alaska slice that's taxable. How big is that family of corporations? And we chose, as New Jersey did, and a number of other states, California too, a two-pronged test. If you had more than 50% ownership, common ownership of the group, or if you had common control through the group, then that made it a consolidated business. And that was the test that was in the regulations and was put into the statute when we had separate accounting. And that is the test that's also here in this bill. After I left office, the Supreme Court was working on a different thought, which was they called it a unitary business. That was while I actually was still in the Department of Revenue. The Supreme Court came out with that. It was called the unitary business and apportionment instead of separate accounting. And they were asked, they did not have a case before them whether it was the UDIPA consolidated group or their unitary business concept was the constitutional test. Didn't do that until about 10 years after separate accounting ceased to apply. And we went back to the slice the pie approach. And in that case, the Supreme Court, the name of the case is Allied Signal versus Director Division of Taxation of New Jersey. And I can give you the citation if you want. The Supreme Court rejected the 50% ownership or control test of UDIPA that we had used and that New Jersey and others had used, and in favor of its own unitary business concept. And so that's the one that you know is constitutionally valid. They rejected the other as the constitutional test. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean, I'm not here to tell you that using consolidated business is unconstitutional. First of all, I'm not your lawyer, so I'm not going to practice law to a non-client. And second, it's not really my place to tell you what the law is. I mean, what you should do is get your own advice and decide how comfortable you are with the term here. It may be that you're told it's like how many angels are dancing on the head of a pin, an exercise in scholasticism. Well, if that's the case, great, then you can do as you think appropriate in that circumstance. Just mention these because there are a couple of things here in the current CS that do have these issues. With respect to the merits of the tax, if you think that separate accounting is going to be a revenue raiser overall for the state, I would ask why. Because you can is an adequate answer, but not a good one. You can put in an income tax on the Alaskan public, too, but you don't. If you want to have an investment in Alaska, just because you can put this in and think that it's going to raise revenues for the state, that may be counterproductive in the long run. I submit it would be. And so you should think about that. If you think that prices are going to remain high, that will keep separate accounting ahead of where apportionment might come out. You know, $120 oil is not where Wall Street put the price of oil for January 2013 delivery. It's a lot lower. I mean, last Friday, I think it was $85. So, you know, the market is betting that we have a temporary situation that's causing prices to be at these nearly record levels, but that they won't stay there. And so as you look forward, you have to also recognize that if prices do come down, then in the economics, people will be getting closer to that crossover point where individual companies might actually come in and ask you, hey, give us separate accounting. And by the way, the department already has discretion to give people separate accounting under paragraph 18 of Article 4 of the Multi-State Tax Compact, which is in AS 43.19.010. That's where it's codified. So that, you know, there is discretion where somebody would need relief. They can get it from the department now. And I think that's pretty much all I have to say right now. I wish I could have checked my facts on my fishing example with Chairman Seaton now that he's back, because I had him selling $2 million worth of fish and making $900,000, and I know he wasn't going to let me get away with that. But I'll close, and if you have any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, and I'm sorry I missed the fishing example as well, as, and I'll catch up later with the other thing. We have a question from Reverend Gardner, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. We back up just a little bit where you were talking about the increasing cost per barrel that we're sort of experiencing on some of the older fields now. And you said that the industry, there would come kind of a tipping point, this is my word, but at some point where it would be much more advantageous for the industry to have separate accounting because Alaska is so expensive. If that is the case, can we assume that opposition to separate accounting today means that Alaska's profitability ranks well compared to profitability in other places?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, well, one could assume that. I don't know whether it would always be correct. Mm-hmm. Again, it's a question of for what purpose would you be wanting to make that assumption? If it's to get, you know, will you get more revenue out of a tax for that? If that's the reason why you want to have it, perhaps in the short term you would, but perhaps in the long term you might not, because it could deter investments that bring the decline of production that allow it to go accelerate. And overall, over you know, the next 10 or 20 years, you might not get as much.
Follow-up, Representative Gardner.
I guess, I mean, setting aside why we would want to do that, if the industry opposes separate accounting today, is it a fair assumption to say it's because it's more beneficial for them to have apportionment today? I mean, given that every company is going to do what's in their own best interest, I mean, that's what they're supposed to do. I'm not complaining about that.
But. Through the chair, Representative Gardner, let me answer it this way. You had testimony, or there was testimony given by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, and it was unanimous testimony of all of its members. And I think there are some members in AOGA who might prefer separate accounting right now. And yet they opposed, they did not endorse separate accounting. They did not think it was appropriate this time. And so I think that companies could oppose it for reasons that have to do with business climate as much as it could be for their bottom line. Their bottom line might or might not be benefited, but they want to have more opportunities to do business here.
Thank you.
Mr. Williams, I had a question kind of relating to that. We are consistently compared on these charts of favorability of where you are, and if we are calculating those favorability climates based on 9.4%, and it turns out that under apportionment, we only get 5.2%. How is it that it's beneficial for Alaska to be seen as a place that is less conducive to a competitive fiscal system when it's a mirage and the actual amount that is paid might be far less than the 9.4%?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the strongest attribute that Alaska could and did have was its track record of stability. There have been very few major rewrites of the oil and gas taxes since 1981. The one notable one then was in 1989, where the ELF got changed. And then we had, lately, we had an ELF decision that was administratively done by Governor Murkowski, and then we had his PPT legislation and the NACES. Those came in quick order. And you know, people, if they know that there's a stable platform, can adjust their forecasting to fit that platform and optimize their ability to invest in the state. It's ultimately, the level of investment that you see here reflects competition, not a cutting off of our noses to spite our face or something like that. As a shareholder in BP, I expect BP to take every investment here that it can, that can do as good a job as someplace else. No more, no less. And so companies don't the biggest thing you could have would be to restore stability. I think in terms of an optimum point, the state has overshot the mark in terms of the level of its taxation.
Mr. Williams, I think you're missing the point.
I apologize.
The point is that the competitive calculations that are put on all these slides that we see have the Alaska as having 9.4% of a corporate income tax. If Alaska isn't getting 9.4% corporate income tax and is only getting 5.2 or 5.7 or whatever number that is, how does that make us competitive when we keep projecting out that we're taxing at a high rate when that's not the actual rate that we receive based on the apportionment formula?
Mr. Chairman, first of all, I have to disagree with the assumption in the question. Alaska always gets 9.4% of the income that's attributed to Alaska, and that will be true whether it's separate accounting under this bill or it's true under the present apportionment formula. However many dollars there are that are attributed to the Alaska business, 9.4% of them are paid in tax.
Okay, so if you run through a formula that does a worldwide apportionment and comes out with significantly different
results than what is being calculated, because what's calculated on the competitiveness scales is always, let's say it's $100 million barrel field, and you run through the tax rates and you put in 9.4% of the value of the Alaska field, not of the field in Azerbaijan or the field in Indonesia or someplace else. It's 9.4% of this 100 million barrel field in Alaska, and the corporate income taxes is added at that. So if that's not accurately reflecting what is being paid, how does that set up Alaska for being seen in this true competitive nature?
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure exactly how to answer the question. I mean, people will perceive Alaska as accurately as they can in terms of what it is, which is a combination of opportunities, operating costs and logistics, and the fiscal regime. And they will estimate for themselves how profitable an investment will be here or not. They will make that investment if it's competitive, whether Alaska is perceived to be number one in the world or number 99 in the world or someplace in between, if it's a competitive investment. The problem is that the present system seems to have gone too far, because you're not getting the level of investment of just several years ago since ACES was enacted. And our company, my company, has testified to the Senate Finance Committee just last Friday that, what it sees as where Alaska could retrench on some of these taxes to make a meaningful change and help facilitate getting the additional investment that's necessary to slow the decline rate or stop it altogether, which is technically very challenging, but it is not impossible. There are huge resources here, very small reserves compared to those resources, but there are huge resources.
Thank you. And on your distribution of apportionment, you said that sales was one thing, and that a dollar made in Alaska, or a gross dollar in Alaska, should have the same margin as anywhere else in the world, so that's the basis underlying the apportionment, worldwide apportionment. However, I presume you've seen the legislative research report of March 2012 that lays out the last 10 years. And, of course, this is ConocoPhillips data because it's the only one that, in its SEC filing, separates out the income per barrel of oil equivalent. And it didn't matter whether you're in year 2000 or whether you're in year 2005 or 2010, every single year Alaska had a higher margin than those other states. So if the basis of your assumption is that the dollar sales is going to give the same margin, and if that is shown as being false, then why would we stick to a program that had the average through those 10 years of 15.10 per barrel of equivalent in Alaska and 9.88 globally, 8.57 international? Why would we assume, when we know the basis of the assumption that sales are going to create the same margin per dollar, and that we have the data that proves that that's not at all accurate, why would that be a good system to not correct?
Well, first of all, Mr. Chairman, I'm not in a position to comment on the principle underlying the apportionment approach as it applies to ConocoPhillips. Perhaps you can ask them if it's... But with respect to the principle itself, it's not my assumption, and it's not really even Alaska's assumption. It was the people who developed what you did, the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act, back after World War II, when they were trying to design a system so that we could have standardized taxes and building codes and a whole bunch of different types of things, fair trade, recording laws, things like that. And this was part of that effort from a bunch of intellectual ivory tower guys on the East Coast. And But I served on the Multi-State Tax Commission, and in fact, The One of the years while I was Commissioner of Revenue, it was Alaska's turn to chair it. So I've actually chaired the Multi-State Tax Commission. I do know their reasoning then, and it still remains that you take it as an article of faith, if you will, and the Alaska Supreme Court has in an Amoco case, Amoco versus Department of Revenue. Thank God it wasn't Amoco versus Williams. There's a couple cases like that. But it was Amoco versus Revenue, and there the property factor was including acreage that Amoco owned that wasn't producing a thing. It was acreage that they had acquired and planned to develop or planned to do a test on, but they had no income from it at all. But the idea is it represents income-generating potential. The court said that the object of this formula approach, slice the pie, is not to get to perfection in terms of measuring, but rather to have it represent fairly the potential to generate income over time. So sometimes one factor or another, you may be ahead of the game, and other factors you may be behind in the game. But the underlying economic evidence that underlies the UDIPA report, which I'd be glad to give you a copy of, it's from like 1949, but not real relevant today. But it's but the point is, there's a lot of sound economic analysis behind it that that our courts and others have bought into and remain.
Sure. And I appreciate you saying that it was an article of faith, because the data that we have shows the faith wasn't justified. So anyway, I'll just leave it at that. And if you haven't gotten that report yet, that legislative analysis of the last 10 years of profitability, profit margins, net income per barrel of oil, so we'd be happy to provide you with that. Are there other questions for Mr. Williams? Yes, Reverend Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. You said that the department already has the flexibility to implement separate accounting if they wish. At what point in your perspective, does a company need to get to be at that point where separate accounting might be an option? And how, I guess, I know that's a difficult question, but how close are we to that point, I guess, in your experience?
Well, again, it depends, obviously, on the particular facts and circumstances of that particular company. Pardon me. The test in the statute is whether using the formula fairly represents the extent of their business activity and its income from that activity in the state. And if it's not fairly representative, which is a very subjective term, but it's designed to deal with all kinds of conditions rather than to be prescriptive and set out a whole volume of thou shalt and shalt not deduct. It's if it's not representative of the income that you can get the relief. And I think generally that means, it has to be material. If you're 5 cents off, don't waste our time. That would be what the department would say. It's what I would have said. On the other hand, if it's imputing 10 times more income than what you can show, and I'm convinced by the numbers, because I've had my auditors look at them, again, speaking as my ex-commissioner, with that hat on, then I would think about, well, maybe they have shown that there's an issue here and that we need to take a look at it, and we would then conduct a full-scale investigation to see whether this was a temporary circumstance or an ongoing one. If it's a temporary one, sometimes people might be entitled to temporary relief, but it's like a headache, maybe it just goes away. But if they have migraines, then that's a different thing.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we have Michael Hurley.
Mike Hurley and a sidekick.
Yeah.
Marie.
And welcome to House Resources this afternoon. And would you go ahead and identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Hurley. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for ConocoPhillips in Alaska. And with me is
Marie Evans, Tax Counsel for ConocoPhillips in Alaska.
Mr. Chairman, since we had already testified on this bill earlier, I didn't want to try and repeat my testimony, but I did want to address some of the concerns and some of the issues that I know have cropped up in testimony on this bill over the last little bit, and perhaps address some of the questions that we had talked about last time. If I may, if I can ask Louis to
and we will get those copied and distributed, so thanks.
It's actually one you probably already have in your packet because it's the 10K numbers from our 2010 10K SEC filing that have the breakdown by jurisdiction of income, expenses, revenues, blah, 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 for all that stuff. And one of the things that I wanted to point out, I did get a chance after you mentioned it last time, Mr. Chairman, to go through and look at that legislative analysis, the Legislative Research Division did. And it is, I don't mean to throw them under the bus, but it's incomplete. And there are some numbers that are missing in there that are very important if you want to try and understand relative margins between different segments of ConocoPhillips business. And when Louis brings those back, we'll talk through those a little bit.
Thank you. Yeah, that's what we're hoping to get from these testimonies, an understanding of all these intricacies.
One other thing that I'll bring up.
And before we go on, I just want to recognize Representative Foster had joined us, and Representative Dick has just rejoined, as well as Representative Heron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One other thing that I'll bring up, I guess that came up on Friday, was the whole ConocoPhillips, what we call repositioning, where we're going to take our company and split it into two different publicly traded companies. Now, that is anticipated to occur the 1st of May, April 30th, kind of at midnight 01 in an instant, when that's supposed to actually happen. But right now, that plan is to split those companies, and we will have two publicly traded separate companies that will be taxed differently. One of the interesting things for us is, you know, right now we have, I think I mentioned in testimony last time, we have 45 different states that we pay state income taxes in. But a lot of those are states where we may only have refineries or gas stations or truck racks or distribution systems. So I expect that once the companies are split, the upstream states where we have businesses in the upstream are going to be different states than we have downstream businesses in. But it's unclear how those are all going to be impacted. If I may, let me try and answer in a different way the question you asked Tom Williams a few minutes ago about 9.4 versus 5 point something.
And just for the record, I was just pulling out numbers. I wasn't saying that those were actual numbers paid by, you know, any particular company. Just for clarification.
I understand. When you look at evaluating something and you're trying to do an evaluation of, for example, ConocoPhillips business in Alaska, and you have a 9.4% rate, it may not be that you're paying 9.4% of your total state income tax to the state of Alaska. One of the things you have to think about is because other states do apportionment. If we earn an incremental dollar of income in Alaska, that is going to go into the big pot that all the other states are going to apportion. So if I have an apportionment factor of 10% in the state of North Dakota. And I'm paying whatever that number is, 5.3% in North Dakota on the apportioned income. North Dakota will be taxing a dollar of additional Alaska income at some small fraction, as will most of the other 45 states. So while I may not be paying 9.4% to the state of Alaska, it's appropriate for me in evaluating investments in the state of Alaska that I recognize the tax impact of all my state taxes of that investment. So if I invest a dollar on the North Slope, it's going to generate income that is going to be taxed in 45 different states, not just the state of Alaska. So my state income tax calculation has to have a blended rate that reflects all of those different taxes that are going to be levied on that $1 of incremental income. So I just wanted to try and explain that. And it's sometimes difficult when you're in that apportioned world and you're thinking about what dollars are going in the bucket and which ones aren't.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wilson.
So are you saying then that if Alaska is 9.4%, but you paid a little bit in this state, and a little bit in this state, and a little bit in this state for Alaska, do you take those parts and add it to Alaska and subtract it from that 9.4%?
What I'm saying is when I'm evaluating Alaska investments, or I'm evaluating, as the chairman was pointing out, I'm evaluating Alaska's competitiveness, I have to take into account looking at the taxes that I pay on an incremental dollar of Alaska income. And that incremental dollar of Alaska income gets taxed in probably 42 of the 45 jurisdictions we do business in, just in terms of states, because it goes into that pot and most of the other states do apportionment, so they get a little piece of it. It's a very complex area, and it's never quite so simple as to sit down and try and figure out, okay, if I invest a dollar and I'm going to earn a dollar in Alaska, how much tax am I going to pay on that dollar? Well, I'm going to pay some to the state of Alaska in production tax and royalty and state income tax in Alaska, but then I'm also going to pay in all these other jurisdictions. And when you start thinking about, I'll give you an example, because we tried this exercise one time and it made my head hurt. We actually tried to figure out, okay, once you do the big gas pipeline into the mid-continent and you're landing 4 BCF a day of gas in Chicago, what is the state income tax impact in the state of Illinois, which has a double sales factor, which is where all of the sales will end up being? It got very, very complicated. And trying to understand whether or not you were going to be able to accurately reflect the impact of that gas pipeline, gas sales, in all the different states where that gas might go. That to be quite a complex little model, just to look at that. That's just an example in terms of that question. If there aren't any other questions on that, if I can, let me go back to my index of financial statements that the chairman's staff just handed out. One of the things you will find if you look at this kind of upper section, these are what are called consolidated operations. And if you refer back to the numbers that are in the legislative research report, those reflect only those consolidated operations, which is the upper half. If you look at the lower half of that page, it's a section that are called equity affiliates. In many different areas of the world, not, you'll notice, in Alaska or the Lower 48, but in Canada, sometimes in Europe, in Russia, Asia, and Pacific, we end up, for legal reasons in those jurisdictions, setting up equity companies and equity affiliates that own those businesses. And they have to be accounted for separately under SEC rules. But Ledge Research ignored those when they did these calculations. So what you will find would be, for example, the Russian operations, several of the Asia-Pacific, Middle East. You would find that the margins per BOE are actually higher in Asia-Pacific, Middle East, and in Europe than they are in Alaska. So
in other words, those should be added in. We probably should ignore the international and the global lines and just look at Alaska and the lower 48 because they don't involve any equity affiliates.
No, actually, Mr. Chairman, I think the equity affiliate numbers are appropriate to put in there. It's just a question of how you structure your business and the way the SEC looks at that structure, which defines breaking it out into these two categories. That doesn't mean it isn't our business.
But what I'm meaning is if we're looking at the graph that we have here and they haven't included international equity affiliates, there are no equity affiliates in Alaska or the lower 48. So Alaska and the lower 48 columns would still be appropriate for looking at net income per barrel oil equivalent, but it would not be appropriate because some of the income for international global was left out, so that there may be a factor there that shouldn't be used. Is that?
Yes.
Thank you, because we'll note that we should not be comparing international and global, and we should just be using our comparisons of the average net income per barrel oil equivalent between Alaska and the lower 48 would be appropriate, but the others would not. So, okay, thanks. We appreciate the clarification there.
One other comment we would like to make, Mr. Chairman, with respect to the testimony you heard from the department on this past Friday, we do actually support the department's idea of adopting as much of the Internal Revenue Code stuff as possible. You may recall one of the things that we talked about in my testimony last time was the fact that it's going to make it very, very difficult for the department, the further we stray away from the code, if you decide to go this way, the further you stray away from the Internal Revenue Code in terms of defining expenses, defining what constitutes revenue, defining intercompany transactions. The department is correct. It will make things much more difficult the further you stray away from the IRC.
Thank you. And that, we all just got the version E that we incorporated those changes, and we've tried to incorporate that. So as, we're going to hold this in committee. So as you get a chance to analyze that, hopefully you're going to see that we've incorporated those changes as much as possible, and if there are other particulars where we missed the ball that is going to make it difficult for you, if this would become law, to implement, we would really appreciate hearing those things. So, I mean, I know nobody's had a chance to look at the version E enough to really comment on it very much now. That's why we wanted to put it on the table and make it available to everybody. But So we are in agreement with you as well, as we were trying to get Ledge Legal to draft that. So if we've missed that mark, we'll appreciate you coming back to us with specific suggestions on that as well.
Okay. Very good.
And also, I just wanted to point out that we did do in there, we came to the current IRS rules, because we talked about it previously that, you know, currently you have to go back and recalculate all your depreciations based on the 1981 statute. And what we've done in here is said that there'll be transition, and then you'll use the current IRS depreciation schedules, capitalization schedules, just as, so you're not going to have to recalculate all of those things for Alaska. So we're trying to take those, you know, those comments into effect. So again, if we miss that mark in any way, please let us know, and we'll make sure that we get a bill that's most effective for being easily interpreted and implemented.
All right.
And I think I see your.
I would suggest.
Would you go ahead and identify yourself?
Marie Evans, tax counsel for ConocoPhillips.
Thank
you. I would suggest maybe your intention that you just expressed is not in accordance with some of your lines on page 13. So 7 and 8 in specific. So you might. I don't know if you've had a chance to proof this yet.
And that's why I say we wanted to get it available to the public and available to everybody, so we had LegLegal incorporate those comments as fully as we could. If we've missed them, would you please go ahead and, you know, send us an email, drop by.
Okay.
You can testify publicly as well, but if you wouldn't mind, you know, doing it either an email or whatever to the committee, then we will address those issues. There's no intention not to address those issues. So
okay.
If we missed it, we would sure like your comments.
Okay. Finally, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I guess I would close with reiterating, I think, what I did say last time in terms of we don't believe at ConocoPhillips that this particular bill is going to make Alaska more competitive and attract the kind of capital that I think Alaska needs to continue to mitigate the decline in oil production in the state. And secondly, I think from a policy perspective, I would suggest to the committee that this kind of a policy change will make the state actually more hostage to oil prices than they are today. And already the state is very hostage to oil prices. This would only exacerbate that situation and make things more difficult when the oil price cycle turns down, which it always does. With that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes our remarks, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
With the corporate split that's going to occur mm-hmm. April 30th, May 1, whatever
right.
date that's going to be, will ConocoPhillips be, or no, ConocoPhillips, we presume will still be here as an upstream company.
Yes.
Will Phillips 66 be a participant in the state of Alaska as a chemical company or a refinery or a gas station service company?
The best of my knowledge, Mr. Chairman, and we've asked our tax folks, there will be no Phillips 66 assets in Alaska.
Okay.
All the Alaska assets will be owned by the upstream ConocoPhillips company.
So I guess my clarification that I'm trying to get is if Phillips 66 with all of the downstream assets isn't going to be in Alaska at all, is not going to be taxed under Alaska corporate taxes, so whether we do separate accounting or whether we do worldwide apportionment, if it's only the upstream assets, it doesn't seem that there's any more. I'm not understanding why there's more hostage with oil taxes or the price of oil in one mechanism versus the other if the only activity in Alaska is upstream, and so it doesn't have that countercyclical Dow chemical or chemical refinery service station aspect that would be the countercyclical weight, at least from ConocoPhillips standpoint, is what I'm just asking.
And Mr. Chairman, from my particular company's standpoint, that would be true.
Okay.
But I'm only one of several big companies operating up here, although I do want to mention you were pointing out a bunch of the smaller companies that were going to be paying 9.4 when the big majors weren't. I would point out that a lot of those companies are LLCs and actually don't pay any state income tax at all at the corporate level.
And thank you. And I think that's addressed in this last issue of the bill.
Ah.
So anyway,
we'll have to look for that.
Yes, we are not attempting to provide a loophole for oil and gas producing companies not to pay corporate taxes in Alaska on oil and gas production. So if we haven't gotten it yet, give me the email and we'll make sure that we it was attempted to get at that, to make sure it didn't. So thank you very much. Are there any other questions for thank you very much for your testimony. And as you review the bill, if you identify any other issues that we have missed the mark on, we'd appreciate hearing from those.
Thank you.
Thank you. We do have Robin Williams was online. Robin Wilson was online and wanted to testify. Robin, do you have something that we need to get through today, or can we put that off till we get to look at the bill next?
Mr. Chairman, this is Robin Wilson from the Tax Division. I didn't have any prepared testimony. I was told the gentleman there that I was available for questions.
Oh, okay. We had you marked down the other way on this. So thank you. And just to let everybody know, we will hold public testimony open so that as people get to review the committee substitute or any other issues surrounding this and wish to talk to the committee, we're open for that conversation. And with that, thank you for the attention of the committee. And it is 3:03. We'll be adjourned.